Well, I think the president and State of the Union wanted to lay out as strong a case as he thought he could make.
Our intelligence, which of course is very closely linked with U.S. intelligence, was confident that there were these weapons of mass destruction, and it is puzzling that nothing has been found so far.
The Bush administration, rather than working to preserve American freedom and democracy, is working relentlessly to limit civil liberties and stifle dissent in pursuit of political, economic, and cultural hegemony.
Guerrilla resistance was the main reason why U.S. authorities were forced to talk to the elements which they thrown away in 2001.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, July 8th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Earlier this week, the Foreign Affairs Select Committee of the British Parliament completed its examination of the accuracy of intelligence provided to the Parliament in preparation for the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. In a report issued yesterday, the committee cleared the government of misleading the country over the threat posed by Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction. It concluded, however, that unreliable intelligence data was used and that Blair inadvertently misled Parliament. The committee was also critical of claims that Iraq had received enriched uranium from the African country of Niger to restart its nuclear program, and it said that the UK was too heavily reliant on U.S. technical intelligence, on defectors, and on Iraqi exiles, quote, with an agenda of their own, unquote. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with committee chair Donald Anderson.
Essentially, we set ourselves the task of checking whether the information available to Parliament prior to the conflict was accurate and complete. We effectively said that by majority that there was no political interference, that on the evidence available to us that the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee had ownership of that document throughout. We did make some criticisms, for example, in respect of the nuclear material from Africa, the Niger point, which has still not been resolved. We were much more scathing in respect of the second dossier, which has been called the dodgy dossier. It had an unusual putting together in that it was originally designed for journalists, then came into a document for Parliament. It adopted some material from a postgraduate student without attribution, some alterations, so it really was a bit of a disaster. So essentially, we were broadly by majority in favor of the government version, but we did make a number of detailed criticisms of the picture given to Parliament by the government over that period.
So basically you found that there was no political influence in the British government's or the House of Commons decisions leading up to invading Iraq.
By majority, yes.
Now, when you say majority, I saw reports that there was a very slim majority.
I only have a vote when there was a tie. There were six such ties, but on one occasion it was a vote which effectively exonerated Alistair Campbell, the Director of Communications of the Prime Minister.
I know that there was a finding that Prime Minister Blair published an unreliable intelligence dossier and that he inadvertently misled Parliament. Is that the dossier that you're talking about there?
Essentially what happened was that on the 3rd of February he spoke to Parliament. He said that the dossier was based on intelligence sources. In fact, most of it had been lifted, plagiarized from a thesis. Some of it was intelligence, but the attribution had not been given. But when he said that, neither he nor his director of communications were aware of the fact that it had been so plagiarized.
Now, just how significant is the ruling of your committee, and what ramifications, if any, do you think the ruling will have on Prime Minister Blair?
I think it's taken some of the heat off the Prime Minister. He appeared before a committee of those who chair the senior committees of Parliament this morning. He was certainly very confident that we would find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq because, of course, as opposed to the U.S., where the president made it a much wider aim, regime change, in this country, I guess because Parliament so demanded, much more was made of the threat posed by weapons of mass destruction. Therefore, the legal case, the essence of the case rests largely on that. Our intelligence, which of course is very closely linked with U.S. intelligence, was confident that there were these weapons of mass destruction, and it is puzzling that nothing has been found so far. Clearly, there is now a much more technically qualified individuals there. They will be operational shortly, able to interview scientists, and we hope that the Prime Minister will be vindicated.
I want to back up a little bit to the situation with the African country of Niger.
Yes.
Your committee expressed serious concerns over the strength of the claims that Iraq was getting enriched uranium from the African country of Niger to restart its nuclear program. And now we see today where the Bush administration is backpedaling on its previous claims regarding this point. The White House acknowledged for the first time yesterday that Bush should not have made the Niger accusations in his State of the Union address last January. And it effectively conceded that the intelligence information underlying Bush's statement was wrong.
The allegation was not that he'd received this material, the yellow cake, but that the Iraqis had sought it. They had actually received such material from Niger in the 1980s. The information, the written information, everyone now acknowledges was based on forged documents, but the Prime Minister had maintained that there was still other intelligence material which had not been checked out. And obviously we are pressing him to decide on that speedily. There's also the case that a retired U.S. diplomat went there, I think on behalf of the CIA, in March of last year, and reported confidently that there was no evidence in respect of such supply.
How much influence do you think your report will have over here on the other side of the Atlantic?
We are not as powerful as the committees in the U.S. system, in part because of the constitutional status of the U.S. committees, and also, of course, the party system is more entrenched here than in the state. But I would hope that much of the material which we unearth will be of interest. We had a very short, intense program, effectively over 4 weeks prior to the publication of the document on Monday. We did not have access to certain of the intelligence personnel nor intelligence material, and the intelligence committee in the House will be following partly the same ground and will have such access. We hope that they will confirm what we say, but as to our influence, we hope that it will be considered a serious contribution to the debate.
And final question, Chairman Anderson. If Prime Minister Blair, you know, is sort of let off the hook for not having to take responsibility for the fact that this unreliable intelligence dossier was presented, and his communications director does not take responsibility for it, where does the responsibility lie, particularly given the stakes here and the amount of harm that was caused?
On the first document, it was the property, effectively, of the chairman of our Joint Intelligence Committee. On the second document, it was put together by a committee. The provenance was not known at the time, and they claim the lessons have been learnt, and before any document which is in part or in whole based on intelligence is issued, it will have to be endorsed by, in future, by the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee.
Donald Anderson is the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee of the British Parliament. In a front-page article above the fold in today's Washington Post is the headline, "White House Backs Off Claim on Iraqi Buy." The headline is referring to the statement made by President Bush during his State of the Union address to the American people last January, when he alleged that Iraq had sought to buy uranium from the African country of Niger to reconstitute its nuclear weapons program. It was part of Bush's case to launch an invasion into Iraq, and today he's backing off that claim. Walter Pincus is the reporter who broke the story. He spoke with Peace Watch today about what he found.
It turns out that both the British and the U.S. Were dealing initially with information that was circulated by what they will only confess to be a third country in Western Europe, but which we have found out to be the Italians. And it was the Italians who finally, in February of this year, produced the documents sort of in person. And once the CIA received the documents, initially a translation of it, That raised further questions because the names of the people were then apparent who were not in office at the time the documents had supposed to be exercised. And then in March, they got original copies, immediately turned them over to the International Atomic Energy Agency, which was the agency that was doing the inspection of Iraq. And it took them only something like 5 hours to prove they were forgeries.
All right, so help me out with a timeline.
But we don't know who forged the documents.
Don't know who forged the documents, but you know that they came from Italy.
They came, that's what we're being told, they came from the Italian intelligence service.
Italian intelligence service, and it went from there to the UK?
Well, what happened is the information from the documents was circulating as early as the end of 2001. This allegation has been floating around since 2001,
mm-hmm.
and the transaction with Niger was supposed to have taken place in 1991 or 2000.
Okay.
So it's information that was floating around for over a year,
mm-hmm.
but nobody had the documents to support it.
And the UK used this information in their February...
In their dossier in September of 2002,
mm-hmm.
and the U.S. then relying on the UK document, the president in the State of the Union used it. But in the interim, the CIA and, in fact, the State Department had received information that raised serious questions about the reliability of that information, and therefore the CIA kept it out of its statements or the times it put it in. It put in a sort of a question what they do in national intelligence estimates and normally in intelligence papers is to say, here is some information received, but and then they would either say it comes from questionable sources, it hasn't been confirmed, or one of the other departments that does intelligence will put a footnote in saying, we don't agree that this is an accurate piece of information.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's key because despite that, the Bush administration went forward with including it in the State of the Union address, despite the fact that the CIA had discredited this account?
Had discredited their information, and so that's why the president attributed it to the British, and now they're being told that the British information was tainted also.
And so you think that's what prompted the Bush administration to make this announcement or this acknowledgement? Was it last year?
They were prompted by, I think, the problems created not just by the British saying that their information was questionable, the president having depended on it, but also a U.S. ambassador who had been sent by the CIA to Niger and had as early as February 2002 questioned the reliability of the documents. John C. Wilson, who's a former ambassador to Gabon and who was the last deputy chief of mission in Iraq, met with Saddam Hussein as a period of time in Iraq. He was sent to Niger in February of 2002, came back and reported that the people he talked to, and he's an Africa expert, said the allegation was incorrect. And that had been known inside the administration, certainly within the intelligence community, and possibly at the White House we'll still find that out for months.
Hmm. So what do you conclude from this, from your research? Why would the Bush administration go forward with this statement?
Well, I think the president and the State of the Union wanted to lay out as strong a case as he thought he could make, and at one point after the speech, one of my sources at CIA said he thought the president's speechwriters had taken some literary license with the truth. And I think this has been a pattern so far, that a lot of the intelligence that had caveats attached to it were discussed in public by the president, other senior administration officials, without those caveats, and they appeared all to be true in the making of the case to get the Congress to approve giving him authority to go to war and even to get the UN to approve the return of the inspectors.
And how does the Bush administration, in its acknowledgement last night of this, that this allegation, this concession, that this is, they have to back off this claim, how do they explain why they made it in the first place? Or do they continue to point the finger at the UK or faulty intelligence information?
Well, you have to look at the two different statements. The statement that we carried was a statement that said, based on what we know now, which implies they didn't know any better when they put it in the speech. So it gives them an out to claim that nobody in the White House knew that this potentially was wrong information. The statement that they gave the New York Times talks about having other intelligence that let them make the speech.
Mm-hmm.
So that they haven't really, we still don't really know, and perhaps one of the congressional investigations are going to determine who knew what at the time the president made that statement.
Mm-hmm. There are reports that as far back as 2002, in August 26, Vice President Cheney, in a speech, claimed that Saddam Hussein had resumed his efforts to acquire nuclear weapons.
Right. It was a major theme in the summer of 2002 to rally Americans to support the idea of taking action against Saddam Hussein, and that the first focus of his weapons of mass destruction was Vice President Cheney's speech and the threat of the danger of Saddam Hussein getting hold of a nuclear weapon. And this fit into that pattern.
So would you say then that this is, how significant is this that the administration is, you know, conceding that, well, I guess it all depends on the way, the concession that they're making. Basically, they're saying they didn't know.
They're trying to low-key the importance of this, and I think it is the first time they have acknowledged, in effect, they made a mistake, and we'll see what happens next.
Washington Post reporter Walter Pincus, who wrote the article in today's edition titled White House Backs Off Claim on Iraqi Buy. Last Monday, a big explosion rocked one of the mosques in Fallujah, a Sunni-populated city 60 kilometers from Baghdad. The American forces claimed that the explosion was caused by the ignition of ammunition stored in the mosque. But the residents have a very different story. Peace Watch correspondent Ahmed Al-Rawi reports from Baghdad.
The residents of Fallujah City, who live nearby the Al Hassan Mosque, remember the incident well. They say that the imam has two lectures a week, one on Monday and the other on a Friday. After finishing the afternoon prayers, the last prayer for a Muslim in the day, he went to his students to teach them the basics of Islamic religion. An eyewitness says,
"We have been living in this neighborhood for 10 years, and I have been praying here ever since. All the residents of this area meet here to pray. As soon as the imam entered his room, the accident occurred. A rocket was launched in the center of his room, since an aircraft was flying above the mosque at the time of the prayer. Something glittered in the sky seconds after the bombing took place. The matter was planned ahead of time."
Some people admitted the fact that the imam has been preaching in his prayers to end the American occupation on Iraq. Sheikh Laith criticized the American troops' presence in his city, but people denied any mentioning that the imam may have been involved in hostile activities against the Americans. Another eyewitness comments on such accusations.
"These accusations are not right. He is the preacher of a mosque. All the people know him, and his relationship with the area is well known. This man and the youth with him, let God have mercy upon their souls. Most of them did not do their military conscription. They even don't know how to use a weapon."
Many people said there seemed to be a helicopter or an aircraft flying above the mosque before the afternoon prayers. Another eyewitness who refused to give his name said,
"My house is very near the mosque. I heard the sound of five tanks just 10 minutes before the afternoon prayers, Since I wanted to go to the mosque, I wondered at the sight of tanks going around it. The tanks which had black flags on them went around the mosque 3 times. I noticed that the tanks went from the main gate of the mosque up to the highway. I came walking, and when I neared the front gate, I heard the hissing of a rocket, and the flickering became close as the rocket neared the minaret of the mosque.
Many casualties occurred among the students of the imam, whose room and the adjacent one were totally destroyed. The eyewitness has a proof of his statement.
As a strong proof, when the American forces came, they prohibit anyone from entering the mosque. They remained there from 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 2 p.m. the following day. The proof was the presence of a very big hole caused by the rocket. When they left, we found the hole filled.
The new imam of Al-Hasan Mosque, Abdul Aziz Al-Kubaisi, started preaching on the following Friday. He says,
"Let us ponder a bit, gentlemen. I want to address your graceful company, though they are hurt in remembering their mosque's preacher, who stood that Friday on this platform and addressed you, gentlemen. He told you that I will talk on next Friday about heaven if there will be some remaining days in my life. This sentence has been uttered by our sheikh, our imam, our martyr, our hero, the martyr sheikh Laith Khalil."
Many Iraqis are saying that an independent committee should implement a thorough investigation into this incident so as to reveal the truth to the public. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Ahmed Rawi in Baghdad.
We're in a state of emergency, move with urgency for power. This is the final hour, people. Got to understand, we've been catching hell since we fell in this land. So I ran to Iraq to attack the Arab that grabbed his brother's oil. Found myself in turmoil on holy soil, Mecca, Medina, the so-called Middle East, fighting for the rich American beast. In the name of peace, they claim war is a solution, while back home I should be fighting my own revolution. Down with apartheid, internationally, we're in a state of emergency. War no more. We're in a state of emergency. Move with urgency. War no more.
A few years after the invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S. in its search for Osama bin Laden to overthrow the Taliban as part of the war on terrorism, the climate in Afghanistan has deteriorated. The security situation has been compounded by the return to the country of a large number of former Afghan communist refugees, so that United States and Pakistani intelligence officials have met with Taliban leaders in an effort to devise a political solution to prevent the country from being further ripped apart. That's according to Saeed Salim Shahzad, reporter for the Asian Times. According to a Pakistani jihadi leader who played a role in setting up the communication, the meeting took place recently between representatives of Pakistan's Inter-Service Intelligence, or the ISI, the FBI, and the Taliban leaders at the Pakistan Air Force Base in Samugli near Quetta.
When we say that conversation is going on, that doesn't mean that it is going on in a very organized manner. Basically, Pakistani ISI and the U.S. authorities were looking for somebody who could replace the present power vacuum in Afghanistan, especially in Pashtun belt. So they were trying hard to bring in some old factions like old warlords and other people to replace the powerful Taliban movement. Although they were thrown away in 2001, but politically they are still a powerful force. So after making a lot of hectic efforts, they tried to make their inroads through Pakistani-based jihadi organizations, and they conveyed the message to Taliban movement that if they compromise on few points, including the removal of Mullah Omar, they threw away the foreign fighters like Al-Qaeda and fighters from other countries like from Chechnya and from Pakistan and other countries, and there were a few other points, there are possibilities that U.S. authorities would help to induct Taliban. Guerrilla resistance was the main reason why U.S. authorities were forced to sit and talk to the elements which they thrown away in 2001. This resistance movement basically is going on mostly in the Pashtun belt, especially in Kandahar and even in Kabul and near about, and especially in the outskirts of Kabul. And this is very powerful. I mean, in 1979, when USSR invaded Afghanistan, Afghans resisted the invasion, but the intensity was not of that level, I mean, what it is being witnessed at present. There used to be guerrilla attacks in 1 month, but at present, every day, U.S. and allied forces face at least 2-3 attacks in a day, sometimes in one district like Helmand, especially in Helmand and Zabul. These are the hotbeds. The guerrilla movement is in full swing, and the Afghan society is completely destabilized. United States of America, in its mere arrogance, refused to admit few ground realities, that the Pashtuns are the main force in Afghan politics. The U.S. authorities had their own arrogance. That they have been propagating Taliban as in evil elements, and now they are forced to use backdoors to have dialogue with the same regime people. What I foresee is that U.S. would finally be compelled for this kind of negotiation, but U.S. has to realize the ground realities of Afghan society. When they blame Taliban for hardline things and their religious extremism, they have to realize that it is not a new phenomenon. It is centuries-old phenomenon in Afghan society. And Afghan people, they were very much used to with these sort of traditions and these sort of things. So U.S. authorities has to realize the ground realities in Afghanistan. And because, you know, the dynamics of the region is also going to change, and previously, Taliban has differences with Iran and other neighboring countries. But today, when Iran is in the limelight and U.S. aims to destabilize religious clergy, which is in power in Iran, now there is every possibility that the two regimes, the former Taliban regime and the present Irani clergy, which is in power, may join hands with each other and restore some supply lines to help each other for the same cause, which is to damage the U.S. interest in the region. There should not be an obsession with a particular personality like Mullah Omar. I mean, Mullah Omar was not a known figure 7-8 years ago. It was just an icon of a Taliban movement. I mean, so there is a need on the part of U.S. authorities to show some flexibility in their stance. And without showing such flexibility, there is no chance of any further political solution of this issue. The refugees to whom I mentioned are the people who took refuge mostly in the communist countries. And they were former communist people who took refuge in Russia and Central Asian republics and other countries. And they are the people who are mostly returning to Afghanistan. So to me, it is not a sign of any stabilization or peace in Afghan society, but instead, those elements who are returning to Afghanistan would further create controversies and fuss in the Afghan society, because in past also there was a difference between the rural and urban Afghan. The rurals are, as the entire world knows now, that the traditional people, and people say that they are religious, but I call them more traditional and more rigid in their traditions rather. And the urban people are in the Afghan society are very open, and there are refugees which are in big numbers. Approximately, their official figures suggest that there are more than 3 million in Pakistani camps right now under the present Karzai administration. But those belong to the Pashtun belt and south of the country generally do not enjoy the basic rights, civil, human, whatever you can call them. So this is the situation on ground, what I gather.
Saeed Salim Shahad, reporter for the Asian Times. That segment was produced by Stefan Christoph of CKUT Radio in Montreal. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.
Jaga.